Morning. I still think you should come on in, but it's okay. If you want to stay back there, please enjoy it back there. So, over the years that I've been teaching Zen, I've been generally giving instruction about two types of meditation. One of them is one-pointed meditation, where you just keep coming back to your breath, to your body. If you need help with your cognitions, coming back to some saying something when you breathe, like saying, well, I've worked probably with 6 or 8 people over the years who still do their TM mantra. I mean, that's cool. Why not? Bring it back. Use it as your part of your one-pointedness. With your breathing, it works well. Are there your own mantra? So that's one way that I've taught meditation for a whole bunch of years. The other way that I've taught is the Japanese word shikan taza, shikan, which I translate, my own translation. Luckily, Katagiri and Suzuki aren't here. Some nice things about that. The teachers die and then you get to do your own thing, right? That's what people are looking forward to around here. I think. let's see. So, Leo. the second one, Shikan, is bare awareness. And I've been talking about that for years. And last talk, I broke bare awareness. Ooh. Is it this? This, oh, okay. All right. I broke bare awareness down into different components. And I want to do that again today, and I actually asked folks to do an exercise. No exercise today. But the components I broke it down into recognize. So we recognize the anger or the fear or what are the repetitive thoughts that are coming up. We accept them. We restrain ourselves from making a federal case out of it. Now, Dan and I had a conversation about whether restraint was necessary. And it's interesting. I think if there's...
I may have hit play instead of record.
Oh!
I stopped it and said record.
Okay. I think if the acceptance is really large, so it doesn't have to be any restraint. But often our acceptance is a little bit on the feeble side. So we do need to restrain ourselves from going off, and then we lose our awareness completely. But this isn't about repression. That's why I think the acceptance is so important. Because if we repress, we can become what looks like good Zen students, but, we're becoming actually hardened by our Zen practice rather than softened by it. Returning to this, whatever this is. So the acronym then that I made up is RAR. Okay? RAR. RAR. All right? And you can do your own, but that's mine. You can do this one too if you want. We can roar together. So let's say that let me give an example. Since Dan's sitting here, so let's say that Dan didn't show up for Dokusan for one-to-one with me. You know, I do one-to-ones with folks, and he didn't show up and he didn't call. So I'm angry, right? And he walks into the zendo, and I'm sitting here, and he comes in and sits here. When I see him sit down next to me, so I recognize my anger. So recognizing my anger is important. It helps to recognize it, doesn't it? It helps. And then I accept it. And I accept it to as much a degree as I can, and then I restrain myself from going on about Dan. Boy, you know, he's a case. I can't count on him at all, even when he was Zen Center president. He was luckily he's not president anymore. But so I restrain that, and I return to my breathing, to my mantra. I never did TM, but you know, I do TB, whatever. I return. So very simple process, simple, but something that takes practice day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, so you can get it in you. So I want to give some examples, only two or three examples. Well, the first one I want to give is an example where there's the recognition, which is very important. If you don't see the anger, then you're really lost. You have to recognize it. So there's recognition in this one. Well, anyway, let me read this one. This is, I think his name is John Berryman, the poet John Berryman. 77 Dream Songs, and this is Dream Song number 14. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns, we ourselves flash and yearn. And moreover, my mother told me as a boy repeatedly, even to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now that I have no inner resources because I am heavily bored. People bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me. Henry is his alter ego with his plights and gripes, as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me. And the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag. And now it changes. And somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me wag. So there's recognition in this poem. Recognition. He's recognizing that he's caught in a self-centered dream, as we are so much of the time. We are. He's recognizing that there's a picture of how things are supposed to be and how we ought to be able to respond to them. Great literature, valiant art. But he also recognizes that he finds it all boring, that he's bored by it. And he's even bored by himself as alter ego, with its plights and gripes and its complaining about everything being boring. And then, in the end of the poem, I'll read it again, somehow a dog has taken off and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me wag. So he stepped away from the confines of his little self, hasn't he? And he's spontaneous as a dog. Me wag. Me wag. So there's a moment of Zen in there at the end of the poem, which is the recognition. And then this moment of Zen. Unfortunately, several years after he writes this poem, he kills himself. He has trouble with alcohol. He has suicidal tendencies. He has depression. He kills himself. So here's an example, and you know, you'll find this example just all over with poets and artists, of the recognition that makes their poetry so wonderful, without the practice, which means you get the acceptance and the ability to return to just this in you. I just finished a biography of Bob Dylan, and boy, you know, what a poet! What a poet! What insight! What insight! And what an asshole! What an asshole! Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? And we see this time and time again, don't we? With our greatest artists, our greatest poets. This is about it. I want to call them all in and help them. Practice bare awareness. Help them. Because their soul insight is profound and deep, right? But how about living it? How about living it? But only when we accept, when we restrain acting it out, restrain repressing it, and return to just this. So my next example, actually I only have about two or three examples, is Ram Dass. And I talked about Ram Dass a few weeks ago, but why not? I have only talked about him three times in the last 10 or 12 years, so why not? So Ram Dass. So I first heard Ram Dass speak when he was Richard Alpert in something like 1965 or 1966, when he came to my school, Stanford, where I was an undergraduate, and he'd gotten his PhD, and you know what he was talking about then, don't you? So you guys know what he was talking about then?
Acid,
yeah, big time. He was talking about lysergic acid and telling us all to turn on. And, you know, many of the Zen movement probably would not have caught on in the United States if it hadn't been for LSD. I think it would not have caught on. The 60s and 70s, it was experimentation with LSD in the 60s and 70s. And then people like Ram Dass, who moved out of the chemicals into the actual spiritual practice and began really transforming themselves, who were the models. Now, he didn't do Zen, but what's the difference? He did a meditative practice every day. Anyway, so I first heard him speak in 65 or something, 66. Then I heard him speak in something like 85 when he came to the Twin Cities. If anybody can remember that, he came to the Twin Cities. Then the next thing I did was I saw the movie after he had his stroke. A movie about him after he had his stroke. So that's what I'm going to talk about, the film after he had his stroke. which he had a stroke in 97. So by the time he had a stroke, he'd been practicing. He'd given up the LSD in something like 1970. And he had been practicing for, I would say, about 25 years. And remember, he did, for those of you who are old like me, he did Be Here Now in 1971. Seminal book for those of us who were into this Eastern spiritual movement. Seminal. It doesn't matter if we were Zen or Hindu or what we were. Seminal. So anyway, in this movie, which I'm told is on Netflix, I can see in this how he's internalized his meditative practice. He's internalized his bare awareness. So early in the movie, you see him sitting in a car, dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt, and he's picking up his leg with both hands and moving it to the ground very slowly. And then there's an attendant who comes around with a wheelchair. So he's returning. Throughout this whole movie, we see, first of all, that he recognizes the severity of his stroke. He recognizes, and he's accepted it, and he's restraining from pissing and moaning about it.
He's restraining from woe is me. My life is over. I'm just in a terminal depression. He's restraining. Because he's recognized and really accepted. Really accepted with his heart. With his heart he's accepted. So he can restrain. If we do the restraint without the acceptance, as I say, it's very brittle and very cold. And then you're just... That's not what this is about. But even with an open heart, often you do have to restrain a little bit because your mind goes off, maybe even a lot. And then he's returning. He's returning. He's using slowness. He's using caution with his body. You can see that he's developed patience. When I saw him in 85, it was still a lot about Ram Dass. It was still a lot about him. What he'd done in India, his practice, his guru. It wasn't as much about him as in 65. In 65, it was narcissism. It was lysergic acid narcissism, basically. But this movie, which was about 2000, that stuff is pretty gone. Pretty gone. And he talks about how before his stroke, the physical things were easy for him. But suddenly he has many limitations and he uses those to come back, to return to just this and the spaciousness of being here with just this. Also in the movie, the first time I heard him speak and the second time he was glib. Everybody know glib? This guy is glib. Well, what happens to glibness? You get a stroke, right? You get a stroke, and his words are few and far between. They don't come to mind. He says to himself, "If I can't think of a word, I'll give a description, an analogy or metaphor for that will clue the hearer into what I'm talking about." So, his glibness is totally gone, and he continues to give public talks. And I don't know if he's continuing to give them, but he is still alive, as one of you pointed out, a couple of you pointed out when I talked about him last time. But he was giving public talks in the early 2000s, slowly, but with grace. So we can see, or I can see, a disidentification that's taken place in Ram Dass over those years. Finally, with the stroke, maybe before the stroke, I don't know, a disidentification with all those fears, with all those anxieties, with all those worries about who I am and who I should be and how I can have more friends and how I can do a better job. A real disidentification, a real letting go through the practice of meditative bare awareness. Now, of course, he doesn't use the term bare awareness, but the book, Be Here Now, I mean, duh. Duh. And he talks about his experience as his experience of having the stroke, fierce grace. And he says it's fierce because the stroke was such a strong, overwhelming experience. He combines the adjective with grace because he sees the stroke as a gift, since it's taught him a whole bunch. He says, "This isn't what I expected when I got old." Well, this isn't what I expected when I got old. He's actually, when he has a stroke, he's younger than I am now. Maybe this is what I have to look forward to. Maybe this is what we all have to look forward to. We all have some idea of what we hope it will be like when we get old. So in this movie, time and time again, he uses his physical disabilities to help him to return to what's real. That's Zen practice. We use whatever we have to help us return to what's real. We don't need a disability, but a disability could actually help us sometimes. It could actually, if we accept it. In one of the interchanges. He's with a physical therapist, and the physical therapist is. So he used to do hatha yoga. He was real limber and did a lot of hatha yoga. Well, now he can barely lift his arm. So there's the physical therapist is lifting his arm and pushing and pulling it, trying to get it agile, trying to open it up. He says, "Yes, yes." But there's no agitation in his voice. No agitation. No anger. And he's kind of laughing. He's kind of got a little smile on his face. Acceptance. 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 You know what Zen is. You've heard this before. Zen is Buddhism with jokes. That's what Zen is. It's Buddhism with jokes. And the joke is on us, but the joke is on everybody. The joke is on the whole universe. It's a sign of acceptance. It's a sign of acceptance. I don't mean sardonic jokes. I don't mean caustic jokes. I mean just humor. This is a humorous situation that we're in, you guys. It's either tragic or it's humorous. It's both. It's kind of tragic, too. But in Zen, we, through bare awareness, we appreciate this humor. We do. We appreciate it. So another thing I noticed in the movie, and you'll notice it if you look at it, is his emotional openness. Instead of being self-centered, he's laughing a lot. He's cries in the film for about things that he's having a hard time doing, and he's just very warm. He's just very available. So. I think that the disidentification that comes from practicing bare awareness, it comes on its own. You can't force it. It comes only from the practice. And it includes a disidentification with the practitioner. So there's that you no longer identify very much with the practitioner. Does that make sense? That is, the person who's doing the bare awareness begins to just sort of sink into the bare awareness, brings them melt into the bare awareness. So you don't care if you're doing it well or not. You just, well, bad, in between. You just disidentify with all that, trying to do it well or not well, or be calm or be, you know, whatever. Right? Disidentify. Disidentify. But it comes on its own. It comes on its own. The other thing about Ram Dass, other than the disidentification, which is especially powerful for me, having seen him these other two times where he was really... He may have been a spiritual adept, but he knew he was a spiritual adept. He knew it. He didn't think he's a spiritual adept anymore. He didn't think that. He had no idea. The other thing is that after his stroke, he becomes more devoted to helping others. He becomes more devoted to his Seva Foundation, and he puts all his effort into helping others. And that's kind of logical, isn't it? That when we give up putting all this energy into protecting little Tim or little Lainey or little Wanda, that we want to help others. Think of all the energy we put into that. All the worries, all the concerns. Am I going to make it through this next week? Am I going to finally do this or that or the other? When we are able to just disengage from that, disidentify, not by consciously disidentifying, but by recognizing what's coming in, accepting it, whatever it is, restraining ourselves from making a federal case out of it, and returning to just this, to just this. Thank you. And Ram Dass says in the movie, I'm more at peace now than ever, and that comes from settling into the moment. The discipline of living his stroke. We all have something, some impediment that we can live. So he also talks about, and this is a little odd, he talks about how when he first had the stroke, he was taken to the hospital. He was near death. And all he can remember is being in the gurney, on the gurney, in the hospital, looking up at the ceiling and seeing the pipes that crisscrossed in the ceiling. And he's disappointed in himself for the reaction, his reaction. And here's what he says. Here I was, Mr. Spiritual, and I didn't have a single spiritual thought. I didn't orient to the spirit. This is the test, and I flunked it. All that was on my mind were the pipes in the ceiling. This showed me I had more work to do. This is puzzling. I'm puzzled by this. Because that's great. That's the whole deal. So you should go back and read Bihar Now. His own book from 1971. Well, there is a... His teacher was Hindu, you know. In the Hindu tradition... There is this be here now part of the tradition, but there's also a part that has a really welcomes the spirit world and talks about how after you die, you know, or on the verge of death, your guardian spirits and lots of other auxiliary spirits can come to your beck and call. So maybe that's what he's talking about. But anyway, from a Zen point of view, hey, that's it. That's it. Good for you, Ram Dass. We get so caught in wanting to intellectualize our situations. And, you know, here he is intellectualizing his situation, abstracting himself, and forgetting his own teaching. Well, we all forget our own teaching sometimes, so that's just the deal, right? That's just the deal. You should see me behave. You should see me misbehave. Right? So, about 8 years ago, I was in a car wreck. I was totaled. Somebody broadsided me, and I had to be pried out of my car. I can remember my window was shattered, and I couldn't... I was driving, and my car was dented, bent in, and they had to pry me out. And they took me to Regent's Hospital. And they put me on, I don't know if a, yeah, they put me on a gurney. Yeah, they wheeled me in. Wow. Pretty cool. They wheeled me in. And then they examined me. And, you know, prone on the examining table, I remember looking at that ceiling. I remember the patterns in that ceiling. And it was very wonderful. Very wonderful. Of course, I hadn't had a stroke, and it ended up being okay. But sometimes having something traumatic happen to you, or getting to a situation of extremity that you haven't planned, will actually move you into bare awareness, because it moves you out. It's like the Rinzai teacher who comes and hits the student repeatedly. It gets you out of yourself, and you have a flash of bare awareness, a flash of openness. So I want to give one more example, and this is an example from Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, one of the first books I read on Zen. And I don't talk about this much because it's almost a cliche. It is a cliche in Zen, but that's okay. Cliches are cool, too. So this story is a story of this man, falls off a cliff, and as he's falling off the cliff, he grabs a root that's hanging down from the cliff, root of a tree that's next to the cliff, and he's dangling from the cliff, holding onto the root. And those of you who know the story know what's happening. A couple of little mice are gnawing the root up above him, and they've got about, you know, 3/4 of the way through, gnawed through. And he looks to his left, and he sees a strawberry growing. It must be a wild strawberry, right? and he pulls it to his mouth, and he eats it, and he says, "And how sweet it tasted! How sweet it tastes!" That's the whole story, right? But we're all hanging by a thread in our lives. You may not think you're hanging by a thread, but you are. Wait till tomorrow. Wait till next week. You might not have a stroke, but something else is going to happen. Your relationships are going to go sour all of a sudden. The job that you thought you were going to have didn't work out. The economy is never getting better. The 1% are gobbling up everything. You're hanging by a thread, you guys. We're all hanging by a thread. We are. It's the human condition. Sartre had it right. Camus had it right. They just didn't do bear awareness. Bring them in. I'll teach them bear awareness. Bring them in. We're hanging by a thread, our lives. Hanging by a thread. Hanging by a thread. We don't know. We don't know. This is our condition of human existence. Will there ever be a middle class again? A lot of people say they don't know. Will there ever be? I mean, that's what we were supposed to be, the upwardly mobile people. Now, I just got back from France. The French are much more upwardly mobile than we are. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. That's why Europeans came over here, so they could have wives. Now, people are going back to Europe. Well, not exactly, but I go to Europe to see my grandkids. So a couple of years ago, there was this guy who always jogged around the lake for years and years. He's about, I think I saw him do it for about 10 years. Maybe he was 30 when I saw him and did it for about 10 years till he was 40. He was really, had a good physique, had really good muscle tone. I remember my friend Paul said, well, he was a vegan and, he was just in totally toned up in hatha yoga and meditation, and he spent his whole day taking care of himself. And then one day he collapsed and died out by Lake Calhoun. And he was something like 40, and he didn't have a history of any heart problems. So there you go, you guys. There you go. So... in Zen, when we read the old Chinese teachers and to a degree the Japanese, they're poking fun of death, and they're poking fun of getting ready for death, and they're also even competing with each other about who can really die, who can really die with a grin on their faces. And let go of everything. And so there's a lot of joking and sort of one-upping each other. It's one-upping each other, but it's done it's with such levity. So passing the death test. That's what it's about. Passing. And if we learn to die to all that stuff that we need to recognize and then accept, if we die to that stuff, we've passed the death test. We've passed it. So when we actually die physically, it's no big deal. It's just no big deal. Right? But you have to learn to die first. You can do it. You can do it. I'm no one in particular. I'm nobody in particular at all. I just decided that's what I was going to do with my life. Or my death. No difference. Zero, zero, zero. So Zorba the Greek, and then John Kabat-Zinn took Zorba the Greek's saying full catastrophe living. That's the situation, full catastrophe living. But full catastrophe is something we can appreciate. We can appreciate, we can recognize and accept it. This insecurity, this not knowing. Without covering it up, without trying to make it secure, without deadening it with drugs and alcohol or TV or incessantly chatting to ourselves about the same thing over and over and over again. Talk about boring. He thinks great literature is boring. What about this? What about this in here? The ultimate in boring. And maybe as we're dangling from this cliff, as we're dangling from this, by this thread, our feet are scrambling for a foothold. Sweat might be breaking out. It's never perfect. It's just what it is. It's just what it is. Saul Bellow has a novel which I have not read called The Dangling Man. That's what we are, dangling humans. Dangling. We can't find a firm foothold. There isn't a firm foothold. When I was young, I rock climbed. I was always looking for the firm foothold. No firm foothold. We can always do bare awareness and return to just this. This little strawberry. Red, juicy. You know those wild strawberries? They're just so tiny you can barely see them. But you look at them, you pick one. You see the color, that's redness. The juice is juiciness. And then how good they taste. How good they taste, those wild strawberries. It takes a lot of effort to pick enough wild strawberries to have this many in your hand, but it is worth it. It is worth it. Their season is so brief. Northern Minnesota, they're coming, they're gone. Less than a week. That's us, less than a week. We're coming, we're gone. Already I'm 70 years old. How could I have got to be 70 years old? I just was walking my dog and with my bike and my best friend a couple days ago. We were in the third grade. Jeez, what's the deal here? What's going on? Life is gone, isn't it? Life is going. Season is brief of our lives. Our opportunity to be alive with bare awareness is short, you guys. Short. To do the things we really care about. To love the people we really love. To express ourselves in our deepest and most satisfying way. There's not much time, you guys. And yet there's all the time in the world. Don't worry. Don't worry. Opportunities of life, right here, right here. Pleasures and joys and sadness, right here, right here. In the midst of all the angst, all the toing and froing, all the wishing and wanting, all the complaining and hesitating. The story tells us that the precarious person who is me, is brave enough to risk further insecurity by returning to just this little strawberry, just this little strawberry, and enjoy it, and enjoy it. Or maybe it's just this pattern in the ceiling. Maybe it's just these ceiling fans turning. Maybe it's just having tea with a friend and enjoy it. Maybe it's just one breath before we die, one complete breath. If you can learn to do one complete breath in your cushion, you're ready to die. Because on the out-breath, you let go of everything. Everything known, everything unknown. And then on the in-breath, And then the out-breath. Life, death, what's the difference? Don't divide it up. Everybody divides it up. But that's you can divide it up if you want. Divide it up all you want. But do it lightly, okay? Do it lightly. So I want to finish with a poem that isn't directly related to it, what I just talked about. But everything is related, so I haven't said this poem in a while. This is a poem from Golden Age of Chinese Zen by Chodo Ba. The mountains crawl with lumberjacks, axing everything in sight. Yet crimson flowers burn before the stream. That's all I want to say. I'll be glad to take questions, comments. Yeah.
Tim, your stories about the ceiling panels in the hospital reminded me about 3 years ago. I had really life-changing surgery, and I was scared to death. And I was in the pre-op area.
Uh huh.
Just literally terrified.
Uh huh.
And it was one of those areas where you have, you know, the bays, but they're separated by just sheets, and so you can hear what's going on over 3 days.
Uh-huh.
People are all stressed out, and I looked up in the ceiling, and it was just an entirely white ceiling, a white ceiling panel, but right above my gurney, where I was, there was a panel painted of blue sky with white puffy clouds. It was so brilliant that somebody would think to do that. And in that instant, when I looked up and I saw that panel, it reminded me of a very, very special day in my life that took me back to that day. And I am not kidding. In an instant, all of the terror that I was experiencing went away.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I realized at that very, very moment that that surgery that I was going to have, all the stuff that I was going to go through, was just so absolutely important for me to do. It's just so funny that you talk about
that. Oh, that's a wonderful experience. Could you guys hear her? They could hear you. Thank you. Thank you. What else? Questions? Comments? Sure.
A good friend and teacher of mine died about 2 weeks ago. And I went to visit him at Regent's Hospital, actually, about a week before he moved into a hospice. And his name was John. And John knew he was dying at that point. But he said to me that he had become absolutely devoted to the truth, the complete and total truth, that he could no longer hide anything because it was just too big a burden for him. And we both knew what he was talking about because about 2 years previous to that, I had become very dismayed when I realized that John was coming to class drunk. And this happened on several occasions, and I've talked to other people about it. I've talked to John about it, and John at first denied that he had an alcohol problem. And then when several other people talked to him, he came around and admitted that, yeah, well, okay, I probably do, and I'll do something about it. When I showed, there was a 3-minute egg interview with John some years back, and I passed this off to a friend of mine who was a recovering alcoholic. And she took one look at it and said, I should say, John had this protruding belly. And her comment was that that belly was the classic alcoholic death belly. because it was his liver, of course. So looking back on this situation, I can't blame anybody. You know, it's not like John should have done something, or his friend should have done something, or the people around him. There were many people, and still are many people, I think, who were in denial about what his problem was. I think we all do the best that we can in every moment. And all that's left, I think, is that when an experience like this happens, to just go into it as deeply as you can, so that maybe next time you can do things a little differently.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
When the negative thoughts come up, like the anger and the repetitious, like self-defeating stories come up and we just accept that, what about the negative self-judgment that comes right after that?
Oh, before the existence? Yes. Well, that comes up. That comes, and it's possible to accept that too. It's possible to accept that too. But that is, that negativity is so hardwired. That inner critic is so hardwired into human beings, at least in our culture. I don't know about other cultures. That he or she is never going to go away. But through this practice of recognizing the inner critic and accepting him or her, and then restraining the inner critic, but not too much, because if you restrain the inner critic a whole bunch, the inner critic's going to, you know, end run you. The acceptance is so much more important than restraint. What if you don't have acceptance? Well, you'll develop it. You just develop it by sitting. I mean, either you give up sitting or you develop it. Because the inner critic keeps coming up, keeps interfering, keeps telling you you're no good, keeps telling you this is a waste of time, keeps telling you... So that inner critic has to be at some point accepted and even embraced, but just accept it first. The more the inner critic is accepted, the quieter the inner critic becomes. Quieter inner critic. So that's all. I sorry, but that's the deal.
Then when you talked about restraint, it reminded me of something I heard Deepak Chopra say, which was, "What you resist persists."
That's right. No, see, I did see one Zen teacher using this, I mean, you know, what I'm doing is, you know, you can read lots of Buddhism, lots of Zen, and they have lots of acronyms, RAIN and RUR and RUR. But I was talking to one Zen teacher who does the, uses the recognition, restraint, and return. And I just said to myself, geez, where's the acceptance? Where's the acceptance? Because if the recognition, the restraint, and return, it could turn you into, you become very disciplined, but you can also become very tight ass Zen student, very tight ass Zen teacher. Well, maybe you want that, but gee, then you can't die, so that you can live. Because only by accepting can we completely die so we can completely live. Good, thank you. Thank you. Well, Paul is looking at me as if it's time to move on. Or am I just projecting, Paul?
Oh, projected.
Anything else?
You know, Tim, you were talking earlier about this Ram Dass.
Yeah.
More self-aware after he had this stroke.
Yeah.
They say the same thing about the physicist Stephen Hawking.
Oh, yeah.
They said if he hadn't develop this debilitating nerve problem or nerve disease. He would have just been, well, a smart person, but after he went into this the wheelchair, he became brilliant.
Yes. What do you think about that, Leo?
I don't know.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, when these things happen to you, I think you have two choices. You can either go into a just terminal depression. I mean, or you can embrace them. With Ram Dass, he'd been doing the practice for 20 years. I don't know about Stephen Hawkins. He doesn't do a practice, but. He does his own practice. He's brilliant.
He talks about things I like reading about science. The things he talks about, I can't understand.
Yeah.
They're so deep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in Zen, we talk a lot in Soto Zen about the natural koan. That if you stay with this practice, you'll have a difficulty. You'll have a big difficulty. Your difficulty will get very, very big if you stay with it. if you're sincere. Now, if you just blow it off and just go through the motions, that's not the case. But that big difficulty will slow you down, will almost cripple you. But that's when your practice really starts. Because when you're slowed down by your incapacity, you become open and humble, but not fake humble, not churchy humble, right? Not that kind of humble. That's what I think, at least. Okay. All right. Thank you.